Welcome, everyone. We're so glad that you're here. At the end of each row, there's a plastic packet that looks like this. Inside those plastic packets, you will find blue cards. If you're visiting with us, we would love for you to record your visit, as well as green cards for celebrations and concerns. Our scripture lesson today is from Exodus, chapter 1, verse 8, through chapter 2, verse 10. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sifra and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives come to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine boy, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with tar and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." These are sacred stories.
So, a little background on this song. The Carter family. I think like every church should have a banjo and Carter family song probably every Sunday. But in the heart of the Depression, the Carter family, for radio listeners, was really their family. They were broadcast at a Del Rio, Texas, on Xera radio, and the antenna was in Mexico to kind of circumvent certain United States regulations about the amperage you could have on these broadcasts. And my dad, it was so powerful, my dad in the milk barn in Iowa, he remembers hearing Roy Acuff and Hank Snow singing while he was milking cows. That's how powerful it was. And so for people who, rural Americans who were displaced during the Depression, this form of community and companionship was really important to them. And the Carter family came from, I don't make this up, came from Poor Valley, Virginia, in the mountains. And they first recorded in mid-1920s, a about the time that record companies were searching the United States and different regions for regional acts and music. So in that kind of, in those recordings, they found blues musicians and Cajuns and Cajunto music and Native Americans and a lot of Appalachian music. And AP, the Carter family was Alvin Pleasant Carter, who went by AP Carter, and Sarah, his wife, who played rhythm guitar and then sang lead vocals, and then his sister-in-law, Maybelle Carter, who played or sang vocals and then was a killer guitarist, really influential. And AP would scour the hills and the coal mines and the factories and the churches for songs that he could work up with the kind of tight harmonies and the virtuosic guitar of Maybelle. Most men, actually, in a male-dominated guitar world, they couldn't believe that a woman was playing guitar. We, in the narthex, I can tell you her the Carter scratch, it was called, her technique. But the legacy of the Carter family was that they brought rural American music to a modern audience. And so songs like Keep on the Sunny Side or Will the Circle Be Unbroken or Wabash Cannonball have become country and folk standards that work today. So I thought I was actually going to work this up for Time for Children, but I got moved to the big tent. So this song is called Little Moses, and I love it for its childlike quality, and it reminds me of Bible school. So. Away by the river so clear, the ladies were winding their way, while Pharaoh's little daughter stepped down in the water to bathe in the cool of the day. Before it was dark, she'd opened the ark and found the sweet infant was there. Before it was dark, she'd opened the ark and find the sweet infant was there. Away by the river so blue, the infant was lonely and sad. She took him in pity and thought him so pretty, and it made little Moses so glad. She called him her own, her beautiful son, and called for a nurse who was near. She called him her own, her beautiful son, and called for a nurse who was near. Away by the river so deep, they carried that beautiful child to his tender mother, his sister, his brother. Little Moses looked happy and smiled. His mother so good done all that she could to rear him and teach him with care. His mother so good done all that she could to rear him and teach him with care. Away by the sea that was red, little Moses, the servant of God, while in him confided, the sea was divided as upwards he lifted the rod. The Jews safely crossed while Pharaoh's hosts were drowned in the waters and lost. The Jews safely crossed while Pharaoh's hosts were drowned in the waters and lost. Away on a mountain so high, the last one he ever did see. While in him victorious, his hopes most glorious, he'd soon over Jordan be free. When his labors did cease, he departed in peace and rested in the heaven above. When his labors did cease, he rested in peace and rested in heaven above.
The Carter family helped to tell the story. They recorded little Moses on February 14, 1929. Sarah Carter learned the song from an older relative named Myrtle Bays. And Myrtle likely learned it from her grandmother or her aunt. The story is told. It's passed from generation to generation. Reagan helped to tell the story. Away by the river so clear, the ladies were winding their way, while Pharaoh's little daughter stepped down in the water to bathe in the cool of the day. Before it was dark, she opened the ark and found the sweet infant was there. Before the story was ever written down, it was told, shared over meals, whispered to children, sung, and acted. The story begins before the sweet infant Moses is saved by the midwives, before he's hidden by his mother and placed in his own little ark, before he's found and rescued by Pharaoh's daughter. The story of the Israelites in Egypt begins with Joseph, who's sold by his brothers into slavery. Joseph eventually ends up in Egypt and becomes a trusted advisor of the king. There's a famine, and refugees flee to Egypt, seeking shelter and food. Among the refugees are many Israelite people, including Joseph's own brothers. Joseph uses his power to help his people. And because Joseph is known to Pharaoh and in leadership, the Hebrew people are welcomed. By the end of the telling of this part of the story in Genesis, the Israelite people have achieved a most favored immigrant status in the land of Egypt. But a story of welcome turns to one of slavery and oppression when a new Pharaoh comes to power, a king who did not know Joseph. This new Pharaoh seeks to solidify his power by singling out an outsider group and calling them the enemy. Pharaoh tells the Egyptians that the rapidly expanding Hebrew minority is an emerging threat. Professor Dennis Olson writes, "What Genesis describes as God's faithfulness and blessing the Israelites through many descendants, Pharaoh describes as a terrorist threat from an outsider minority that will endanger Egypt's security and way of life." There's no hint in the biblical narrative that the Israelites are anything but good, faithful citizens. Yet the delusional Pharaoh imagines that the growing but small Israelite minority in Egypt is too numerous and too powerful. He warns the Egyptians that in the event of war, the Israelites might join Egypt's enemies and fight against Egypt. Pharaoh responds by trying three different but ultimately unsuccessful strategies to beat down the growth of the Israelite people. First, Pharaoh enslaves the people, and then Pharaoh commands the midwives to kill Hebrew boys at birth. And finally, Pharaoh commands all Egyptians to throw Hebrew boys into the Nile River. Pharaoh tries to end the story of the Hebrew people. He forces the Israelites into slave labor to build two of Pharaoh's supply cities. The cities serve the oppressive Egyptian economy and the distribution of goods rigidly controlled at the top. But the more the Israelites are oppressed, the more they multiply and spread. Their story continues and expands. Pharaoh seeks to diminish and weaken the Israelites, and when his first plan fails, he decides to separate families through slaughtering baby boys. He commands the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, to kill Hebrew male babies as they are born. In the Bible's first act of civil disobedience and nonviolent resistance for the sake of justice, the midwives refuse to obey Pharaoh's deathly command. They lie to the authorities, breaking the law for the sake of justice and life. They appeal to Pharaoh's bigotry. The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. With their fingers crossed behind their backs, they report, "Hebrew women are like animals. They're not civilized and patient like Egyptian women." And Pharaoh believes them because they played into his fear and his ignorance. And so the male babies are saved by the civil disobedience of the midwives. And the people multiplied and became very strong. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." From economic oppression to ordering the midwives to murder, to ordering the whole Egyptian population to throw Hebrew baby boys into the Nile. The Pharaoh, in his delusional fear, continues to ramp up his hatred and destruction for the immigrant population in Egypt. After this final, most egregious plan is announced, the story moves from general to particular, from an order of genocide for all the male babies to the story of a single male baby born to a mother who hides him as long as she can, and then does exactly what she's been ordered to do. She throws her baby boy into the Nile River. Well, almost. She makes him a waterproof basket, his own ark, and places him in the river, an act Pharaoh meant for death, an act that will become his salvation. Pharaoh saw threat only in the boys. Little did he know that the story of salvation for the Hebrew people would begin with women and girls. The courage of the midwives who refused to obey an unjust command. The wisdom and ingenuity of Moses' mother who follows the letter of the law while working for life. The clever sister who watched after Moses' basket boat, who suggested their mother serve as wet nurse for her own child, and Pharaoh's daughter, who saves Moses from the genocide ordered by her own father. The story continues through the courage and the action of women. It continues as Moses grows up, and the story reaches God's ears. When Moses, once grown, encounters God in the burning bush, God says, "The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians. I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." The story reaches God, and God, knowing of the suffering and oppression of the people, God hearing the story, must act. Co-creating with Moses, they seek freedom for the people. Pharaoh saw the immigrant community growing numerous, and he was afraid. There's nothing to suggest that he had any reason to be afraid, but fear is like that. Fear seeks the feeling of security, not reason or truth. Pharaoh first oppressed the immigrant population with slavery and an unjust economic system. And when they continued to grow, he separated children from their families as a strategy of control. In an article entitled "Barbaric: America's Cruel History of Separating Children from Their Parents" by Deneen Brown, she describes a mother's piercing screams as her baby was ripped from her arms during a slave auction. Even as the lash cut her back, the mother refused to put her baby down and climb atop the auction block. Until the end of the Civil War, it was common for slave owners to rip families apart by selling the children or the parents to other slave owners. Henry Bibb, a former slave, recalled a woman pleading for God's mercy in an 1849 narrative that's part of the Weeping Time exhibit at the Smithsonian's Museum of African American History and Culture. But the child was torn from the arms of its mother amid the most heart-rending shrieks from the mother and child on the one hand and the bitter oaths and cruel lashes from the tyrants on the other. Beginning in the late 1800s, thousands of Native American children were taken from their families, their tribes, their homes, and sent to boarding schools. At the boarding schools, the children were forced to assimilate. They were stripped of their language and culture. Often they were physically abused. There were Japanese internment camps and children separated from their families due to differing abilities. The story of oppression, especially through families ripped apart, is not new in our history. But while it is not new, it is particular now. We're hearing of specific families, of mothers and fathers told their children being taken to get cleaned up and then never seeing them again. Stories of a father who signed over his parental rights without being able to read the form he was signing, without understanding what the form meant. These stories, as they reach our ears, they must compel us toward compassion and action. While the deadline to reunite ripped apart families by our governments, most recent efforts at separation has expired. Hundreds of children are still being detained without their families, and some may never be reunited. The story continues. The story of oppression and injustice reaching God's ears and God using us. Using midwives and sisters, using mothers, using shepherds and brothers, using fathers, using us. Some of us need to take on a more active role in the story, doing what we can do with courage. Some of us need to work harder on sharing the story, on making sure the story can be told, that Pharaoh never succeeds in keeping the story from reaching the ears of those who will be co-creators with God to do the work of justice, the work of care, to let the people go. Each line we contribute to the story adds up. Good things don't get lost. Our efforts against the domination systems of the world, against violence and injustice, our work for the realm of God's peace, it adds up. It matters. We are part of the story. Oppression can give way to freedom. Justice is possible. But change only happens when we let the story reach our ears, only when we get involved, only when we join the work to create the realm of peace for which we long.